From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour began on Reddit after the Women's March on Washington on January 21st. Reddit users wondered, what about a march for science? After all, the new administration has been hostile to basic science when it comes to climate change, and there are widespread concerns about funding and research cuts. Well, the idea snowballed and was eventually endorsed by a number of mainstream science organizations. But those organizations stressed that the March for Science was not a political event. It was about the value of science, supporting climate research, not choosing political battles. Naomi Oreskes is a professor of the history of science at Harvard and said last week, quote, "I can't think of a time where scientists felt the enterprise of science was being threatened in the way that scientists feel now," end quote. Well, the march became a global event with marches for science in 600 cities worldwide on every continent. Yes, a small band of scientists in Antarctica made signs and cheered on their colleagues. And so, just as we did following the Women's March, we're asking, what's the impact? What can change? How can we pull politics out of science? Let's be honest, the mainstream organizations might have declared that the march was not a political event, but right now, there is an uncomfortable political split when it comes to science. And just about everyone agrees that ideally, science would not be political. So let's talk about that. My guests for the hour include David Williams, the Dean for the Research and Arts for Research in Arts, Sciences, and Engineering at the University of Rochester. David, welcome to the program.
Thank you.
Also here is Matthew Hoffman, Associate Professor in the School of Mathematical Sciences at RIT. Matthew, welcome to you.
Thanks, Evan.
Welcome to Stephanie Gallant, Chair of the Organizing Committee for the Rochester March for Science. Stephanie, welcome.
Thank you, Evan.
Also here is Adam Rich, Associate Professor of Biology at the College at Brockport. Welcome to you.
Thank you.
And Jason Zemanski, Assistant Professor of Geosciences at Monroe Community College. Jason, welcome to you.
Hi, Evan.
Okay, so I just want to start with where you guys were this weekend. I know, is there anybody in this room who did not march and would not march because you did not think it was a good idea? No? No. Some of you did not march because your schedules did not permit. Stephanie, I think I'll start with you. Where were you this weekend?
I was the organizer of the march, so I stayed at Martin Luther King Jr. Park.
Okay.
So I physically didn't move with the crowd to the Hyatt, but I was here from 7 a.m. until it ended.
How many people marched?
We had about 1,700 people marching.
More than you thought or less?
Much more than we thought. We were hoping for about 700, so we were pleasantly surprised.
Okay. Why do you think that was? Why do you think the turnout was so strong?
Because science matters. And science matters in Rochester. I think that we were an accessible event. We were a family-friendly event. So people who normally don't take part in events like this because they feel that they are political or they feel that they're not safe could feel safe at an event like ours. We were sanctioned by the RPD. We had all our permits in place. We had accessibility for people who were blind, accessibility for people requiring American Sign Language. So we really tried to be an event that people wanted to come to so that they could learn more and see what the next step is.
I know you've seen what other organizations, big organizations, mainstream organizations have said, saying, look, this is not political. It feels like it's sort of impossible to take politics out right now. But was it a political day for you?
We've been saying that it is a political event, but we're nonpartisan.
Political but nonpartisan.
Yes.
Okay.
Science and fact and reason doesn't belong to one political party. But because science, the government is involved in the decisions it makes for its people, and that involves science and using fact and using science. So science by nature is political just because the way our government uses it.
So let me just ask you before I turn to the other guests here, do you really believe that right now it's nonpartisan?
Speaking for myself, I do not. But the march tries its best. The National March and the March in Rochester tries its best to be a nonpartisan event.
Ideally, should it be nonpartisan?
Yes.
But right now?
It doesn't feel that way.
Okay. I appreciate the honest answer there. David Williams, how do you feel about it? Right now, is science political and is science partisan?
Well, it really shouldn't be. It can't be. And the key strength that scientists bring to society is the fact that they are all about finding out what reality is all about. They're about discerning the truth among a whole variety of competing alternative views of what the world is like. And we need to stick with that mission and advise people, not about politics, but advise people about the nature of the world. So when it comes to global warming and climate change, we need to be providing the best information we can, the best solid data upon which Policymakers can make decisions, but that's not the scientists' role. Their role is to provide the data. And I think what's disappointing now is that we're seeing that data being disregarded because of political interests. We're not getting the kind of audience that we need to have because people in earth sciences are making discoveries about our planet that we really, really, really need to pay attention to. And I would use the analogy, if you have a little discomfort in your chest, who are you going to go talk to about that discomfort? You're going to go see a doctor, right? You're not going to go to a politician for advice about what's wrong with your chest. You're not going to go to a cigarette manufacturer to find out.
Maybe going to a doctor is elitist.
It's elitist? I don't think so. I think everybody on this in our country would choose a doctor before anybody else. Who else would they go to?
No, I'm being obviously facetious and provocative, but that on the political side, we've been attacking elitism. I think what you're saying is we should value elite thinking or high level.
Let me just finish this analogy,
and
then I'll come back to the elitist thing because I think you're raising a very important point, and I'm glad you raised it. But I just wanted to say that you know, if you're worried about the planet, not your lungs or what might be happening in your chest, but you're worried about the planet. If you think there are some symptoms that are suggesting that it's sick, you're not going to go to a politician. You're not going to go to a representative of an oil company. You're going to go to the people that spend their lives studying the planet and what's going right and what's going wrong with it. And you're going to listen to them. And you may, in setting policy, you may not take their advice, but at least you'll know that that's the single source that's going to be the most reliable about what is happening to our planet. With respect to elitism, you know, one problem that science has is we come across as arrogant and know-it-all, and we don't communicate well with people who are not in academia. We do a miserable job at that. And I think we need to get better. We need to figure out how to get our message across as normal human beings, which we all are, in a way that communicates and doesn't come across as elitist and arrogant, because it does.
All right. One of the big questions for the hour, and I just because you raise it now, I'll follow up with you and I'll ask you right now, David, is this. You're right. Most people, when they have chest pains or other problems, they're going to see the doctor that they think best corresponds to their medical needs. Why is it that right now, with the planet showing symptoms of illness, we are so split as a society, or at least in this country, on simply listening to the people who would be kind of the corresponding expert to that? How did we get here?
We got here because politics is being conflated with science. They're getting confused. And the politicians who have their own agenda, in many cases, are not paying attention to the experts. And these are people. But one thing that's important to understand about scientists, if you think they're arrogant and obnoxious, you're probably right in many cases. But on the other hand, one thing about their culture that it's really important to understand is their careers rise and fall on whether they're right or not. It's not about how much money they make relative to their peers. Their success is completely governed by getting it right. And if they publish a paper that is wrong, their careers tank. So that's the kind of person you want to listen to, not someone who has an interest in developing fossil fuels, not someone from a pharmaceutical company who wants to sell you a drug. You want to listen to someone who has an objective read on a particular situation. Then you can take those data and you can do what you want with them in terms of policy. But at least you'll know with confidence that you're listening to somebody whose career depends on getting it right.
Matthew Hoffman, how did you feel about not only the march, the turnout that you saw around the world, but what that means at this particular moment?
I thought the turnout was excellent, really, really inspiring to see. I was there with my wife and my two kids and a bunch of colleagues. And it was a really neat atmosphere to see all of those people out there so supportive of science in general. And I think the march did a very good job of being as nonpartisan as possible. I mean, I think it, you know, the statement was that it was a celebration of science. And I think that for the most part, that really was what we saw. And I think for me, as I said, with the family, with young kids, it was good for them to see that too. And so it was an enjoyable experience. And it's nice to see the turnout everywhere too. There was this discussion of scientists being bad communicators. And I know that that has shown up in some of these critiques that you were referencing. And I view sort of marching in this as an extension of getting out there as a scientist, having a public presence, and trying to communicate the science to other people, that it is something that makes, I know, me and I think a lot of scientists uncomfortable, but I think that's part of the reason to do it. And so I see the march as not being distinct from communication.
Sure. Uncloister thyself and hang with us Philistines. That's exactly. Great. Let me turn to Adam and ask, do you agree with Professor Oreskes from Harvard, who said, I can't think of a time where scientists felt the enterprise of science was being threatened in the way scientists feel now? Do you agree with that?
Well, I do. And I think for most scientists like me, I'm not an earth scientist. I'm a physiologist, and we think really about funding and how difficult it is. We're really worried about proposed cuts. I do want to push back a little bit on scientists being arrogant or elitist. I think that's really untrue and maybe unfair. I think that there's a misunderstanding of maybe how we communicate. Sometimes we're blunt. We argue. And I don't even think we need to be correct to preserve our careers. I think that we need to really look at the data and have that sort of scientific habits of mind. I heard a talk by David Helfand from Columbia, and he says, thinking like a scientist, we use data and we have a willingness to see. So we don't just believe. Instead, we think about the data, and we might have a hypothesis, but we might change it. And those things might change as we have new tools to measure better.
New evidence?
Yes, yeah. So I think maybe the public sometimes doesn't understand science. And if we come off as thinking it's too complicated for people to learn, we're absolutely wrong. So and now with politics, your original question.
Yeah.
Do we feel threatened? Absolutely we do. I mean, we're called fake. And I don't know the last time I was ever at a meeting or talking with a scientist and he or she told me that I was fake. They might disagree and think I made a mistake.
Or they say that you're venal and that you are, you know, self-serving, that funding is all about preserving your own career in a gravy train and off the taxpayers or off of university dimes when it's not really about anything else. That's another allegation.
Yeah. So of course, I push back really strongly on that. But what I will say is we all have a responsibility, and whether we go on the march or we share what we learn and what we believe and how we do it, I think is really, really important as teachers and as scientists and as citizens.
Okay. Jason, how about you when it comes to this moment? Any concerns with what you saw with the march this weekend? And you know, where do you come down on how effective scientists are at communicating with the general public?
I think the march was appropriate. I think that science by nature isn't designed to communicate with the general public. We are an institution that builds upon a body of knowledge, and that knowledge is sometimes technical, it's sometimes specific to an audience, and that is very robust over time, but we're not really geared to work with the public. There are other institutions that help disseminate that information to the general public, media sources, but there is where the disconnect might be and where some of those communications get skewed.
Okay. Well, I think we've set the table, and I want our listeners to help drive this conversation. We've already have the phone lines lit up. Before I take your calls, I will tell you that, here's the number. There's a couple lines still open, 844-295-TALK. That's toll-free, 844-295-8255 or 263-WXXI if you're calling from Rochester, 263-9994. I did want to read one of the, I don't know if it's criticism. I think it is concern about the march potentially backfiring. Writing for the Washington Post, Robert Gebelhoff had the following to say, as someone who I think supports science, supports climate science and the value of it, but worried about some of the optics here. Here's what he wrote. I'll read it at length and then our guests can discuss it. Quote, "The March for Science may be the largest political event that the scientific community has ever mustered. With the wrong messaging, this could further entrench the public's polarized view of academia. The fear is that the event comes off with an overtly partisan tone. No doubt, much of science is undeniably political, but adopting an anti-administration tenor could do real damage to the credibility of scientific research, at least for the conservative half of this country. This isn't just a hypothetical concern. Research shows that people believe scientists lose credibility when they engage in advocacy. The march was inspired by the National Women's March after President Trump's inauguration and has been criticized for politicizing science and appearing too leftist. The event is even going he wrote this before the event. The event is even going to feature pink knitted brain hats, strongly alluding to the pink hats worn by protesters during the Women's March. And if the March for Science is not a response to Trump's election and policies, the large-scale interest from participants definitely is. Of course, scientists have legitimate qualms about this administration, but we've already politicized science to the point that party identification determines our beliefs towards science-related issues. Still, it's worth pausing and considering what impact this march could have on the general public. When scientists start dabbling in political demonstrations, they put themselves at risk of being labeled as ideologically motivated. It also delegitimizes their voice when politicians actually do seriously disregard scientific evidence. End quote. Matthew Hoffman, how do you feel about what you just read her there?
So I feel like, for the most part, the idea that this is a response to this administration, I mean, there's definitely a response to the budget, right, that has been put out and the cuts across the board to funding. And that's something that science funding in general has, for the most part, been pretty bipartisan, right? I mean, the Bush administration was increasing science funding and things like that. So this has not been traditionally a partisan issue.
I think it remains that way in the House.
Yeah. And so the response, I think, so far as the administration goes, is to this specific budget and cuts to NIH and NOAA and sort of across the board to the agencies. And so I think in that regard, and in terms of what is being politicized, when there's this discussion of it has already been politicized, there's this question of by who. And I don't think that, you know, there's been a science movement, for the most part, that has been politicizing this, that it's generally been other forces that are accounting
sure.
for that perception.
In other words, if James Inhofe brings a snowball to the floor of Congress and say, look, it snowed in May, therefore no climate change, that's politicizing it and also not understanding the science of it at all. And is it the fault of scientists for wanting to push back?
Yeah, and if we step in and say that is not an accurate representation of climate.
This writer might say, how dare you? You can't do that.
Right, then that's not, right. That,
it's
very hard. I don't view that as political on my part.
Okay. David, what did you think of what you heard there?
Well, I agree. As individuals, we need to speak out very loudly because everyone needs to understand that there are very real negative consequences of the kinds of reductions that have been proposed in the 2018 budget. An 18% decrease in the NIH budget and even more draconian cuts to the Environmental Protection Agency. These things are going to have real consequences on the long-term ability of the United States to lead in science. This is not these are not subtle cuts that are being proposed. These are major cuts. And one of the things that I think frustrating for me as a scientist is that there's a very real problem we have. Now, I mentioned the problem with communication before, but in addition, we tend to be overlooked for our contributions because we might develop some technology. Take your cell phone, for example, or your smartphone. We're all enamored of this new technology. It's wonderful, and we tend to credit Apple with developing the iPhone, for example. But in fact, that technology rests on a pyramid of thousands of researchers, most of whom were in university environments doing fundamental research on how electrons move through silicon and other related matters, without which we would never have had the iPhone. But think about healthcare. The University of Rochester produced the HPV vaccine, which by itself has saved millions of lives, preventing millions of women from getting cervical cancer. That requires dollars. It requires a contribution from every taxpayer in order to continue to deliver those kinds of benefits. And they take a long time. You know, science is a very rigorous, careful process. You can't do it overnight. You can't do effective science in the time scale of a single election cycle. It might take 10 to 15 years for an invention to make it into commercialization. So it's very important to continue to fund this initiative, so all these initiatives, so that they can reach fruition, not only now, but in 10 years.
Jason, when it comes to what we heard from this writer, he would probably point out, look, I understand what everyone at this table is saying, but basic research shows that when the public sees what they perceive as advocacy, they feel like scientists are stepping into a different role that they're not comfortable with, fairly or not. Is that fair?
I think that's a measured statement. We're, as scientists, not trained for that role. It's not what we set out to do. I think we're curious about the world, and we want to go explore it. But when it comes down to policy and decision-making, and we see that our findings are being abused in the political realm, I think that's when our voices need to be heard. Many of the decisions that are being made, like, for example, the debates that occurred last October, climate change wasn't even mentioned.
That's right.
Because it doesn't poll well as a topic. It's kind of interesting. So,
well, the media didn't do a great job asking about it either.
There wasn't any questions raised about it.
Yeah.
So I think we need to call attention when there's abuses being made in Washington about it.
Okay. Adam, how do you feel about what you heard from the Washington Post writer, who's a little worried about the optics here and the public perception?
Well, I think the public perception is there. He's right, of course. In terms of that, I don't know what to do about it. You know, if there's evidence and opinions and we don't share it, how can people learn? So that's a challenge for all of us.
Kind of an extraordinary moment then, it seems.
I would say. And I think I don't think it'll be over quickly.
What do you think?
One of the goals of the March for Science was to get scientists out of their comfort zone, but not to be alone, to join with citizens. And I'm not a scientist. I was just a concerned citizen.
Yep.
And I met several scientists on our committee, and we could bridge that gap. Our march ended in an expo. Many of the satellite marches ended in a teach-in or an expo where citizens could learn about the scientists in their neighborhood. We have so many scientists in Rochester. We have so many industries that depend on science and innovation that even as somebody, I feel that I'm educated, I learned so much more by attending this expo and seeing what scientists in Rochester are actually doing, how what they do impacts me as a human being. And that's one of the goals for the National March for Science and certainly one of our goals in Rochester. And regarding the hats, the March for Science did not endorse any sort of hats. We sold shirts. As a fundraiser.
A lot of the shirts were pretty cool, by the way. I have to say.
So we sold shirts as a fundraiser. But whenever you have an event this large, you're going to have people who want to participate, who do their own thing. So there might have been a group of people who knit pink brain hats that wasn't endorsed by the march. But again, when you're having thousands and thousands of people worldwide join an event, they're going to bring their own spin on it as well.
Okay. So in our second half hour, let's get our only break and let's take some of your calls. And let's talk about, you know, what our guests think we can do to get the politics or at least the partisanship out. Though I think Adam was making a very important point, though. When you look at the House, it doesn't necessarily reflect the same priorities as this administration. So to the extent that this looks like it's partisan, it's really aimed at an administration that, frankly, ran kind of outside of partisan Republican circles anyway. So it might not be as partisan as it looks, but just a direct response to some very specific and occasionally hostile to science language, posturing, and actual policy. So very interesting points, but I want to take some of your calls after this short break, and we'll do that next. Coming up in our second hour, we talk foster care with a national foster care advocate named Rob Scheer. He's a former foster teen himself. He ended up homeless, got his life together, and he and his husband have adopted 4 kids out of the foster system. They also founded Comfort Cases because they don't want to see kids in the foster system carrying their entire life in trash bags anymore. He's in Rochester today. Rob's story next hour. Welcome back to Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. If you're just joining us, we're talking about the recent March for Science in roughly 600 cities around the world, including Rochester, roughly 1,700 people. And one of the organizers, Stephanie Gallant, is here saying that they had maybe 1,000 people more than they even expected in Rochester. And that was true in so many cities around the world. We're hearing from a number of people in our scientific community, not only their thoughts about what they saw this past weekend, but what it means right now for this moment, this political moment, and how to make sure science doesn't get conflated with politics or sort of pushed too far into policy. You know, what's the sort of the appropriate response to this extraordinary moment? So let's go ahead and take some of your phone calls, and I'm going to start with David. Go ahead, David.
Yes, I would suggest that positive, you know, well-informed advocacy is the virtue, not the vice. But science is not just being attacked from a political slash. economic standpoint, but also from a religious fundamentalist standpoint in the opposition, for instance, and the denial of teaching evolutions in so many schools in so many states. And I would like to maybe hear some discussion about that. Thank you. I'll take it off the air.
David, thank you. Anyone want to weigh in first on what they just heard there? Well, I'm going to have to call on someone, so go ahead, sir.
Okay. So I think regardless of what issue we're talking about with regards to science and education, what all of us, I think, as scientists would advocate is that whatever education is being done is, right, in terms of the politics, in terms of the education, what's important is presenting the evidence and the manner of thinking to get to a conclusion. And with policy decisions, with, you know, students, they will come to a conclusion. Our job is to present the evidence and then equip people with the ability to analyze it.
Professor Hoffman, on that point, David on Twitter, different David, says we need to differentiate science from scientists, get people to trust the scientific method and critical thinking. So, you know, this similar idea here, that if people understand and trust the method, then they could judge the scientists based on their fidelity to that method.
Yeah, it's interesting. There's been a number of studies that I've seen reported that basically trust in scientists, I think, is reasonably high in America, but that doesn't mean that the results that are quoted are trusted, right? So people in general, you say, do you trust scientists? Sure. Yeah, I trust scientists. But then do you trust this result? No, not really. Even if they know it was done by scientists. And there's
is that
been
confirmation bias? What is that?
People have
speculated. Motivated reasoning?
Yeah, I think it's a combination of people not wanting to admit they're wrong. But also, I think people have discussed this issue of people not really knowing scientists, right? Scientists is this sort of abstract thing. And so if scientists are more visible, right? I mean, people always cite the study that, you know, 30% of Americans couldn't name a living scientist. And, you know, there was a Twitter campaign that went on with people, scientists posting, look, I'm a scientist. This is what a scientist looks like, that I thought was a fairly, you know, I enjoyed that. And I think this idea that more people need to be aware of what science and scientists look like, I think, can help.
Yeah, and maybe this is a good point to follow up with David Williams, who said earlier that you think sometimes this label of scientific arrogance is deserved. You know, Adam pushed back a little bit on that, but do you agree with what we're talking about right here, which is at least being more visible, more accessible? I mean, where did the concern about arrogance for you come from?
Well, I would agree with Adam that certainly not all scientists are arrogant, but there is a perception. There is a perception that scientists are arrogant, and it's the perception, really, that we need to deal with as much as the reality.
And so how do you change
that perception? And the way you do that is by you get scientists out there talking to the community in lay language, step down out of their laboratories and just tell it like it is, and what's really what their interests are, what they're learning about the world, and how that's relevant to them. There is a sense still that scientists live in this ivory tower, isolated from reality. They're contemplating their navels, and they're getting paid big bucks from their tax dollars to do nothing but look at their navels. And that's just not true. Scientists are very competitive, like businessmen and women. They're working very hard to around the clock in some cases to find solutions to very, very serious problems like the problems of disease and so on. And that culture, unfortunately, also has one example would be, in order to publish a result, we sort of have a universal agreement among our fellow scientists that you have to be 95% sure you're right in order to even get a publication out about an idea. You have to have a 5% or 1 in 20 chance of being wrong. So there's this tendency to be very conservative in what we say. And in fact, we tend to criticize each other when we're out there a little too visible in the public eye, saying a little bit too much about how important our results are. And certainly when there's any hint of any financial involvement that might be biasing our results. There are strong rules within universities to try to protect against that kind of bias and to encourage objectivity. And all of that tends to make us very ineffective marketers, frankly, even when we're right about things. And I think that needs to change somehow. We need to preserve that objectivity, which is the core.
Well, and then let me endorse David on Twitter's idea of really drilling home at early educational levels what the scientific method is and why this is not a religion or just a faith without evidence, and that even when you think you're 95% right, you're going to have colleagues who are looking to poke holes in it, and that is celebrated and important in the scientific realm. You know, so David on Twitter, I like that idea. Adam, do you find a little more common ground with David Williams after that?
Sure, absolutely. I think that I agree teaching the process of science is important. Scientists say words like this result is consistent with our hypothesis. They never say it proves it. I think we do need to teach more the process. We need to teach more how we think like a scientist, and that can run K through 12 or in the first few years of college. It's a difficult thing because students, at least that I interact with, are really good at remembering. But this kind of questioning authority is difficult. They don't like it when a professor says, I don't know, I'm not sure. And scientists say that all the time, you know, and then they'll say, well, this is what I think, and here's why I think it. And that's science to me.
Okay. Stephanie Gallant, you want to jump in too?
Yeah, I'm an early childhood educator. And to me, science is the process. It's not the results. To me, watching a seven-month-old crawl across the floor, find a toy, question the toy, put the toy in the mouth, you know, think of what that means, offer the toy to a friend, that's the scientific method right there. That's observing, that's making a hypothesis, this is food. That's trying it, that's testing the hypothesis, that's asking for peer review. You know, that is the scientific method, and that's how we as humans have learned, and that's how we learn as children, and that's how we continue to learn. And as long as schools are promoting learning and not knowing the right answer, and discovering and not what is discovered, the process of learning and the process of science is what brought me to March for Science, because you don't have to be right or wrong. You have to be willing to find the answer and willing to trust your results.
Jason, let me follow what David's going to say. I know David wants to jump back in, and then we'll come right back to your phone call. So if you're on the line, hang there. We will come to you. I think about conversations that we've had on this program about, you know, sort of potential discoveries, medical advancements, those things. I am sure I could find instances of myself being guilty of overexcitement, not because I'm on anybody's team or I'm trying to enrich anybody, but because everybody wants Alzheimer's treatment. Everybody wants therapies that will really help millions of people. Everybody, and our community, we'd take a lot of pride if they came from here. I think the media sometimes oversells. I think David makes a good point that, you know, the process is the process, but sometimes people are human. Sometimes we oversell a result, or, you know, we have that moment where, you know, it happens. And but I also fear that in those instances of either the media overreporting, or sure, scientists are people, sometimes they oversell a result or use a word like prove that they shouldn't have used, that the public is too quick to lampoon and say, see, we can't trust science, as opposed to occasional human beings misstepping. How do you feel about that?
Yeah, I think when scientists make claims, that oftentimes they are and sometimes quite sensationalized. And I worry that sometimes is what people...
Usually the media doing it, by the way.
So I teach global climate change, and just saying the word global warming has now become a sensationalized statement. I can't say that without it becoming political or anything. So I think that it's been inflated and sensationalized overall. Teaching it is a challenge because I think that basic, as was mentioned, like the understanding of the nature of science, science reports its error, and people often confuse that with that they're uncertain, but we report uncertainty. And so sometimes I think that gets overinflated and taken the wrong way.
All right, let me turn back to David Williams before we jump back on the phone, the Dean for Research in Arts, Sciences, and Engineering at the University of Rochester. Anything you want to add here?
Well, I just wanted to come back to the point about education, because I do think that's so critical. If we're going to maintain our position as a leader, world leader in scientific research and engineering research, and even in arts and humanities, we need to create reinstate the reality that these are valuable professions to join. And right now, when you have political leaders really acting in a hostile manner toward the results that are coming out of the scientific community, some of these results being vetted by almost all the scientists in the world, in geoscience, for example, agree on whether you want to call it global warming or climate change, there's a temperature rise, guys, and we got to get real about that. And so if you're getting pushback about the validity of what science does, it discourages young people from adopting this this as a career. If there are uncertainties about funding, it's not a place where students, graduate students, want to go. They'll divert into industry. They'll go into legal profession, other avenues.
We're losing
young people, and we're losing them.
Future scientists.
Because
right
we're
now.
Not uniformly conveying the message that science is critical for our economic success. Even if you don't care about science and all you care about are financial issues, more than 50% of the economic engine for this country comes from science and engineering in universities. And if we don't keep that pipeline flowing, bringing bright young minds into that those disciplines, we are going to be a second-rate nation before you know it.
All right, let me get back to your phone calls. John in Rochester next. Go ahead, John.
Yeah, hi, Evan. Nice program today.
Thanks.
My question is, I could be off point, is there's a lot of news, a lot of time is spent on news, and not much on information, which your panelists, one of them had mentioned, as far as peer-reviewed journal articles. And how can we get like more information into news or into the news space? And that way we may be able to better educate all of us, including myself. And I can take my answer off the air. And it's a really nice program. And that's the question I have, is like, how do we get like more peer-review information in the news, or writers, journalists that even cite references? Anyways, that's pretty much my kind of ideas for today.
Okay, thanks, John. I'll start with Dave, and we'll go around the table. Go ahead.
So I have a comment about that, because I think it's a very, very good question, and something I don't think I know the answer to, but I think we better find out the answer. You know, when I first learned that the internet was going to become a reality, and I was so excited about it, because I thought, oh, finally, we have a global information conduit that will allow everybody to know what the truth is. We'll be able to communicate the truth so effortlessly now. Everyone will be tuned in. And it turned out to be exactly, my thinking was exactly wrong, right? Because there's so, what it has done is it allowed the opportunity for many, many voices to each express their own opinion. Almost anyone can have a voice now.
Drowning out expertise.
And drowning out expertise. And it's very difficult to know for any of us what is a fact and what is not. And so I think your comment is right on. If we could somehow develop the kinds of processes for peer review that have made science so successful, where your peers, if you're not familiar with what that is, by the way, it's that every time you try to publish an article or you try to get a grant funded, your peers, experts in your field, are called in to weigh in on the validity of what you've done. And they scrutinize very carefully what you've done. And you don't get published or you don't get funded if your ideas don't pass muster. And I think we need a similar sort of rigor in evaluating this incredible flood of information that's coming over the internet now. It's just difficult to parse.
Professor Hoffman.
So I think echoing that, and I feel like saying the same thing I've said already on the show, is that I think that since it is easier to get this information out, I think there is, even though it's not traditionally considered a real job by scientists, for us to try to do some of that ourselves, right? To talk about this on some of these various resources, be it, you know, sharing papers on Facebook or Twitter or any of these sorts of things, and trying to have these conversations more with other people. And, you know, I certainly noticed following a bunch of scientists on Twitter, for example, you see people post things, you see discussions that happen with other scientists. And so, I mean, there is some of this that goes on that can be really helpful. But I think a lot of it, you know, there are a lot of good science journalists, right? And there is a lot of good science journalism that happens. But also, I think for some of us scientists, actually trying to have more discussions with the journalists to try to get it covered better is important as well. We shouldn't feel like that's dirty, and I feel like we sometimes feel like that's sort of selling out to talk to journalists.
People like me?
Or try to promote ourselves. I know.
Oh, you're a good guy.
Professor Rich, what do you think?
It's getting better. We have open source journals. I think that the media is sort of a first pass. It's the first interaction with the new studies. And the media doesn't always do the deep dive. I mean, if you see the newspaper, that's the first show, and that's your first interaction. Now we might see an hour-long documentary, which may or may not have all the facts. You know, it definitely doesn't have all the facts. But then if you go deeper, you can see these peer-reviewed journal articles, and you can always see that there's two sides to everything. I think that people have every right and should be encouraged to look deeper or to have disbelief when something smells fishy or feels fishy. And that's where the thinking starts. And that's where you implement a little bit of the scientific process. So I think that it's each person's responsibility, and we have to share that.
Professor Zemanski, what do you think?
I think we have to maybe a two-prong approach. One would be more agencies to help. It's a great question, by the way, to distill down some of the science and make it more accessible to the general public. But on the other hand, spend more energy and investing in education that would bring a population, help them be more literate in the findings that we're reporting. So I think both of those approaches would be effective.
I will say just my own thought on this, John. It's a very good question. I wonder in my mind if there is an organic fix to this problem coming or if it's going to take more effort. And here's what I mean by that. Anytime you get a new tool, you get excited and maybe then you abuse it a little bit, and then hopefully you learn how to do it better. And then, you know, take an example. Everyone is sort of learning in this new generation of smartphones. And we are hoping that we're not all going to be addicted to our smartphones forever for every meal and every conversation we have. And that, of course, it was exciting for a while, but now we're going to learn to moderate it. We're going to use them, but we're going to naturally have better conversations about what's appropriate, what's not, as opposed to the first few years where everyone's using them all the time. That's an optimistic view, I know. But when it comes to the internet, I mean, you should check out a book called The End of Expertise by Tom Nichols. It's a great read. And he makes the point that you're making, that right now, just that David Williams is making, that right now, it's like expertise is viewed as some kind of arrogance, and that everybody has an equal opinion, damn it, and you're going to listen. And I don't care, you know, who you are. Who do you say you are? Well, I have an opinion too. And the internet has done that. David is right. Tom Nichols' book addresses that, and it's this idea that we need to get past that. And I'm hoping that we're still in the age of infancy and that eventually we're going to start realizing how uncool it is just to be trusting any random guy on the internet. And to also uncool to be expressing our own opinions and shouting down experts who actually have training. But that may be too optimistic. I think there's going to be some pushback to that, but I think it's going to be real effort championing the scientific method and having real conversations about it. So I wish I were more optimistic, but I appreciate the phone call. Bernard in Fairport, next up. Go ahead, Bernard.
Hi. Well, it's a little late for me to make my point, but I think the statement about the seven-month-year-old learning science is the important thing that I look at. I think the fact of the matter is that scientists shouldn't treat with themselves as separate from society. And I think that politicians should know science. And so I think the problem that we've come up with is, by virtue of the system, we have separated science and scientists out from society. So, for example, if you're a scientist taking biology at the U of R, you work in one building for 3 or 4 years. In fact, you need to go across the land to get to take an English class. So it seems to me that scientists need to stop saying, I'm a scientist, and therefore I don't have to know how to talk to somebody or how to interact with somebody. And if you want to call me a scientist, I'm willing to acknowledge that I have some kind of limitation in terms of understanding politics. Scientists and math need to be integrated into our society. Our education system needs to stop separating it, and politicians need to understand scientists just like psychologists and economists and so on and so forth. So it just seems to me that scientists have basically allowed themselves to be separated, and they need to bring science and English, if you will, into the world. I don't like the separation of it from the rest of the world, and they shouldn't tolerate it.
All right,
that's my point.
Bernard, thank you so much. That sounds a lot like what Professor Hoffman was saying. You know, just so you want to follow up with that?
Yeah, I would say I completely agree with that, and I was just going to share that, you know, when we talk about whether science marches are political, there's also this aspect of us as scientists, you know, I'm a citizen, and so caring about politics is something that I am entitled to do while doing science. I have one of my best friends from college when I was a math major in college. He's now a DC lobbyist, but he used to always yell at me, you know, you need to know more about politics. Stop, you know, you need to be able to name all the Supreme Court justices. You need to be able to know about your government. And he used to always yell at me. And that's something that I sort of, I've always taken with this, those sort of arguments.
And I would add to that in a friendly manner. I would love it if more scientists took public speaking and communication. And, you know, no, I honestly, because the great communicators are just gold. And I think everyone at this table, I'm not just saying this, communicates very well, but everyone knows brilliant minds who just can't communicate very well with the lay public. And that does present a barrier. Bernard, I appreciate the phone call. I want to read an email. It's radioactive, but I'll read it anyway. Robert says, I've always found it unfair that science isn't allowed to the political table, but religion is. If a politician came out and said he really appreciates Einstein's theories, they could be chastised. But if they said they love Jesus, they're more likely to be elected. Maybe it's just me. That's from Robert. Does anybody want to touch that? No? No? Speaking yes, on, Stephanie, go ahead. The non-scientist at the table.
Because I don't think that science and religion have to be mutually exclusive. And our committee here in Rochester, of the 16 of us on the committee, about 10 of us were practicing religious. And we can believe in a God, and you can believe in scientific method. And they don't disprove each other.
Okay, I will just say, maybe this is a conversation for a future show. And as I say this, please, I hope I don't offend anybody, because this is not any sort of a condescending viewpoint. I'm just observing. We have a lot of religion in this country, and there's a lot of religion in the world, and a lot of religion is believing without evidence. I know instantly I'm going to get emails from people saying, that's not true, that's not true. But largely it is. I mean, faith is belief without evidence, or, you know, as someone who went to Catholic retreats in high school, I can tell you how much conversation we had about that. And I don't mean to malign that. I'm just observing, and I'm wondering if we are teaching belief without evidence, does that have an impact on the broader scientific community? Does that have an impact on how we evaluate science? That is a future conversation that I'm going to try to have in a humble and fair and open-minded manner. It's not for right now. Though, Jason, did you want to, you're grabbing that microphone, please bail me out here. I'm in a lot of trouble right now.
I was just going to mention that when I teach a lot of these complex scientific ideas, at some point, my students need to make a decision, and oftentimes it's a leap of faith. If they're not fully trained in the science, then they have to defer to our expertise.
That's fair.
Yeah, so I think that...
But that doesn't mean there is no evidence. That means they understand that they don't have the same training, and they are going to respect an expert who does.
Right, but at some point, that's a belief, right? You have to take it on faith, my faith, right? That what I'm saying is the truth, and the satellites are telling us the true information. We're kind of making that assumption, right? That the data that we're collecting is real.
Yes. Have I ever programmed a satellite? No.
Right. Right. Yeah. Right. Okay. So I think it comes down to a decision for the general public at one point that it mirrors faith a little bit, but it is evidence-based, and science is transparent enough where people could verify things for themselves. Whereas religion, it's not an easy thing to verify.
Fair to say. Yeah. You know, and everyone else is looking at me like, play dead, move on. So I will. We will revisit this on another day. And again, I really hope that's not offensive. I mean, I don't mean to be offensive. I'm just opening the conversation. We'll revisit it. Let me just try to wrap the program. We've got 90 seconds left, so let's be real tight. David, prescription. What are we going to do next here that's going to change this kind of partisan or political tenor for science right now?
I think the next step, whether you're a scientist or you're not a scientist, we need to communicate with the leadership in our country. We need to be communicating with our representatives to explain just how important science is for our health and for our future society. It's critical, and it would be even better. So the scientists, well, there are issues about science and their ability to communicate, but it would be even better if non-scientists, the business leaders in our community, for example, were making this argument, because Rochester is all about, is very much about research.
Adam?
Well, wow. I wasn't ready for that. I think that science is all about opportunity. There's a lot to learn. People can have fun, and scientists are regular people.
Okay.
Communication, echoing that, but also I wanted to say that, you know, funding, studies have shown that funding for research, basic and applied, has generally been a good investment whenever they've tried to measure it.
Okay.
Science is a community endeavor, and its goal is to help preserve life and protect property and to further our way of life, so that's a better way of life.
And Stephanie.
I would like to encourage people who'd want to get more involved in uniting politicians with scientists to check out marchforscience.com. The national website is trying to do just that and encourage people to take the next step. Our march was just a stepping point.
And by the way, we didn't even get to the fact there's a climate march. People's Climate March is this weekend, right?
Yes.
And there's a Rochester equivalent as well. So I should have that detail in front of me. Trust me, if you Google it, you're going to find it. I got so hung up on other matters this hour, and we couldn't even get all your phone calls and emails. Just flooded a lot of interest on this subject, and we had a wonderful panel. Our thanks to Jason Zemanski from MCC. Thank you, Jason. Great having you. Stephanie Gallant, chair of the organizing committee for the Rochester March for Science. Thank you, Stephanie. Nice having you, Professor. Professor Rich, thank you for coming from the College of Brockport. Professor Matthew Hoffman from RIT.
Thanks.
And Dean David Williams from the University of Rochester. Thank you so much. Let's get a short break, and much more Connections is next.